堂听 class.com。
Welcome to Side B， 欢迎你来到 B 面。
Lesson 38.
A thief who dropped a winning lottery ticket at the scene of his crime has been given a lesson in honesty. His victim, who picked up the ticket, then claimed the $25,000 prize, managed to trace him and handed over the cash. The robbery happened when maths professor Vinicio Sabatucci, 58, was changing a tire on an Italian motorway. Another motorist, who stopped to help,stole a suitcase from his car and drove off. The professor found the dropped ticket and put it in his pocket before driving home to Ascoli in eastern Italy. Next day, he saw the lottery results on TV and taking out the ticket realized it was a winner. He claimed the 16 million lira prize. Then he began a battle with his conscience. Finally, he decided he could not keep the money despite having been robbed.He advertised in newspapers and on radio, saying, I'm trying to find the man who robbed me. I have 60 million lira for him. A lottery win. Please meet me. Anonymity guaranteed. Professor Sabatucci received hundreds of calls from people hoping to trick him into handing them the cash. But there was one voice he recognized, and he arranged to meet the man in a park. The robber, a 35-year-old unemployed father of two,gave back the suitcase and burst into tears. He could not believe what was happening. Why didn't you keep the money? He asked. The professor replied, I couldn't, because it's not mine. Then he walked off, spurning the thief's offer of a reward.
Fantastic! 棒极了!
Lesson 39.
Shanghai. Car rentals are becoming more and more popular as an inexpensive way of taking to the roads. Business people...Foreigners and families alike are making good use of the growing industry. The first car rental firm opened in Shanghai in 1992, and now 12 car rental players are in the game, with more than 11,500 cars in their books. The largest player, Shanghai Bashur Tourism Car Rental Center, offers a wide variety of choices, deluxe sedans, minivans, station wagons, coaches. Santana sedans are the big favorite.Firms can attract enough customers for 70% of their cars every month. This figure shoots up during holiday seasons like National Day, Labor Day, and New Year's Day, with some recording 100% rental. The major market force rests in the growing population of white-collar employees who can afford the new service, said Zhuang Yu, marketing manager of Shanghai Angel Car Rental Company.
Lesson 40.
Holiday makers who are bored with baking beaches in overheated hotel rooms head for a big igloo. Swedish businessman, Nal Bergqvist, is delighted with his new hotel, the world's first igloo hotel. Built in a small town in Lapland, it has been attracting lots of visitors, but soon the fun will be over. In 2 weeks' time, Bergqvist's ice creation will be nothing more than a pool of water.We don't see it as a big problem, he says. We just look forward to replacing it. Bergqvist built his first igloo in 1991 for an art exhibition. It was so successful that he designed the present one, which measures roughly 200 square meters. Six workmen spent more than 8 weeks piling 1,000 tons of snow onto a wooden base. When the snow froze, the base was removed.The only wooden thing we have left in the igloo is the front door, he says. After their stay, all visitors receive a survival certificate recording their success. With no windows, nowhere to hang clothes, and temperatures below 0 Celsius, it may seem more like a survival test than a relaxing hotel break. It's great fun, Bergqvist explains, as well as a good start in survival training.The popularity of the igloo is beyond doubt. It is now attracting tourists from all over the world. At least 800 people have stayed at the igloo this season, even though there are only 10 rooms. You can get a lot of people in, explains Bergqvist. The beds are 3 meters wide by 2 meters long and can fit at least 4 at one time.
Lesson 41. Many cities around the world today are heavily polluted. Careless methods of production and lack of consumer demand for environment-friendly products have contributed to the pollution problem. One result is that millions of tons of glass, paper, plastic, and metal containers are produced, and these are difficult to get rid of. However, today, more and more consumers are choosing green and demanding that the products they buy should be safe for the environment. Before they buy a product, they ask questions like these. Will this shampoo damage the environment? Can this metal container be reused, or can it only be used once? A recent study showed that 2 out of 5 adults now consider the environmental safety of a product before they buy it. This means that companies must now change the way they make and sell their products to make sure that they are green, that is, friendly to the environment. Only a few years ago, it was impossible to find green products in supermarkets, but now there are hundreds. Some supermarket products carry labels to show that the product is green. Some companies have made the manufacturing of clean and safe products their main selling point and emphasize it in their advertising. The concern for a safer and cleaner environment is making companies rethink how they do business. No longer will the public accept the old attitude of buy it, use it, throw it away, and forget it. The public pressure is on, and gradually, business is cleaning up its act.
Lesson 42.
Betty and Harold have been married for years, but one thing still puzzles old Harold. How is it that he can leave Betty and her friend Joan sitting on the sofa, talking, go out to a ball game, come back 3.5 hours later, and they're still sitting on the sofa, talking? What in the world, Harold wonders, do they have to talk about? Betty shrugs. Talk? We're friends. Researching this matter, called friendship, psychologist Lillian Rubin spent 2 years interviewing more than 200 women and men. No matter what their age, their jobs, their sex, the results were completely clear. Women have more friendships than men. And the difference in the content and the quality of those friendships is marked and unmistakable. More than 2/3 of the single men Rubin interviewed could not name a best friend. Those who could were likely to name a woman. Yet 3/4 of the single women had no problem naming a best friend, and almost always it was a woman. More married men than women named their wife or husband as a best friend, most trusted person, or the one they would turn to in time of emotional distress. Most women, says Rubin, identified at least one, usually more, trusted friends to whom they could turn in a troubled moment, and they spoke openly about the importance of these relationships in their lives. In general, writes Rubin in her new book, women's friendships with each other rest on shared emotions and support, but men's relationships are marked by shared activities. For the most part, Rubin says, interactions between men are emotionally controlled, a good fit with the social requirements of manly behavior. Even when a man is said to be a best friend, Rubin writes, the two share little about their innermost feelings. Whereas a woman's closest female friend might be the first to tell her to leave a failing marriage. It wasn't unusual to hear a man say he didn't know his friend's marriage was in serious trouble until he appeared one night asking if he could sleep on the sofa.
Hey, man, how long am I got to sit here and listen to this bullshit, huh? Somebody tell me.
Lesson 43.
The easy way out isn't always easiest. I learned that lesson when I decided to treat Doug, my husband of 1 month, to a special meal. I glanced through my cookbook and chose a menu which included homemade bread. Knowing the bread would take time, I started on it as soon as Doug left for work. As I was not experienced in cooking, I thought if a dozen was good, 2 dozen would be better, so I doubled everything. As Doug loved oranges, I also opened a can of orange and poured it all into the bowl. Soon, there was a sticky dough covered with ugly yellowish marks. Realizing I had been defeated, I put the dough in the rubbish bin outside so I wouldn't have to face Doug laughing at my work. I went on preparing the rest of the meal, and when Doug got home, we sat down to Cornish chicken with rice. He tried to enjoy the meal, but seemed disturbed. Twice, he got up and went outside, saying he thought he heard a noise. The third time he left, I went to the windows to see what he was doing. Looking out, I saw Doug standing about 3 feet from the rubbish bin, holding the lid up with a stick and looking into the container. When I came out of the house, he dropped the stick and explained that there was something alive in our rubbish bin. Picking up the stick again, he held the lid up enough for me to see. I felt cold, but I stepped closer and looked harder. Without a doubt, it was my work. The hot sun had caused the dough to double in size, and the fermenting yeast made the surface shake and sigh as though it were breathing. It looked like some unknown being from outer space. I could see why Doug was so shaken. I had to admit what the living thing was and why it was there. I don't know who was more embarrassed by the whole thing, Doug or me.
Lesson 44. New York, 9 November, 5:27 p.m. yesterday. Biggest power failure in the city's history. Thousands of people got stuck in lifts. Martin Saltzman spent 3 hours between the 21st and 22nd floors of the Empire State Building. There were 12 of us, but no one panicked. We passed the time telling stories and playing word games. One man wanted to smoke, but we didn't let him. Firemen finally got us out. It was the best night we've ever had, said Angelo Carraro, who runs an Italian restaurant on 42nd Street. We had lots of candles on the tables, and the waiters were carrying candles on their trays. The place was full, and all night, in fact, for after we had closed, we let the people stay on and spend the night here. The zoos had their problems like everyone else. Keepers worked through the night. They used blankets to keep flying squirrels and small monkeys warm. While zoos had problems keeping warm, supermarkets had problems keeping cool. All of our ice cream and frozen foods melted, said the manager of a store in downtown Manhattan. They were worth $50,000. The big electric clock in the lobby of the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in Midtown Manhattan started ticking again at 5:25 this morning. It was almost on time. Lesson 45.
James Cleveland Owens was the son of a farmer and the grandson of black slaves. His family moved to Cleveland when he was 9. There, a schoolteacher asked the youth his name. J.C., he replied. He thought he had said Jesse, and he had a new name. Owens ran his first race at age 13. After high school, he went to Ohio State University. He had to work part-time so as to pay for his education. As a second-year student, in the Big Ten Games in 1935, he set even more records than he would in the Olympic Games a year later. A week before the Big Ten meet, Owens accidentally fell down a flight of stairs. His back hurt so much that he could not exercise all week, and he had to be helped in and out of the car that drove him to the meet. He refused to listen to the suggestions to give up and said he would try event by event. He did try, and the results are in the record book. The stage was set for Owens's victory at the Olympic Games in Berlin the next year, and his success would come to be regarded as not only athletic, but also political. Hitler did not congratulate any of the African-American winners. "It was all right with me," he said years later. "I didn't go to Berlin to shake hands with him anyway." Having returned from Berlin, he received no telephone call from the president of his own country either. In fact, he was not honored by the United States until 1976, 4 years before his death. Owens's Olympic victories made little difference to him. He earned his living by looking after a school playground and accepted money to race against cars, trucks, motorcycles, and dogs. "Sure, it bothered me," he said later, "but at least it was an honest living. I had to eat." In time, however, his gold medals changed his life. "They have kept me alive over the years," he once said. "Time has stood still for me. That golden moment dies hard."
Hey, man, you're making great progress. 你正在取得巨大的进步。
Lesson 46. About 10 men in every 100 suffer from color blindness in some way. Women are luckier. Only about 1 in 200 is affected in this matter. Perhaps, after all, it is safer to be driven by a woman. There are different forms of color blindness. In some cases, a man cannot see deep red. He may think that red, orange, and yellow are all shades of green. Sometimes a person cannot tell the difference between blue and green. In rare cases, an unlucky man may see everything in shades of green. A strange world indeed. Color blindness in human beings is a strange thing to explain. In a single eye, there are millions of very small things called cones. These help us to see in a bright light and to tell the difference between colors. There are also millions of rods, but these are used for seeing when it is nearly dark. They show a shape but no color. Some insects have favorite colors. Mosquitoes like blue, but do not like yellow. A red light will not attract insects, but a blue lamp will. In a similar way, human beings also have favorite colors. Yet we are lucky. With the aid of the cones in our eyes, we can see many beautiful colors by day, and with the aid of the rods, we can see shapes at night. One day, we may even learn more about the invisible colors around. Lesson 47.
Jean Driscoll can go faster in her wheelchair than the world's best marathoners can run. In April, Jean finished the Boston Marathon in 1 hour, 34 minutes, 32 seconds. That's about 33 minutes faster than the winning male runner. She competes on the track, too. She was second in the 800-meter wheelchair race at the 1992 Olympics. Jean doesn't like to be told she's brave. "I'm not in sports because I'm courageous," she says. "It's because I'm a competitive person." Jean was born with spina bifida, a birth illness that damages the spine. She began to use a wheelchair to get around in high school. Then she tried a wheelchair race and was amazed. "Players banged each other and fell out of their chairs," she says. "It was fun." Jean tried other wheelchair sports. At the University of Illinois, her wheelchair basketball team won 2 national titles. Now Jean coaches and teaches. She tries to get people to set goals. "When I sign my autograph," says Jean, "I write dream big and work hard."
Lesson 48. The old advertising slogan, "So simple a child can do it," has taken on new meaning for me. A few weeks ago, I got a computer, but I am mechanically illiterate. I knew that children had no fear of the future, so that seemed a good place to seek help. I asked my nephew, 12 years old, at an elementary school, to help me. My nephew took the machine for granted and has simply accepted the fact that computers are now a way of life. He plays with them and does his homework on them and even creates programs for them. I, on the other hand, am terrified by what this equipment can do. It can interchange paragraphs, switch words around, and even correct my spelling. It informs me of its limitations, takes commands, and asks questions. It even seems to have a sense of communication. Rather than accusing me of making an error, it prints, "One of us has made a mistake." It never gets tired and is always patient and ready to go when I am. I think it was somewhat normal for me to be suspicious of computers. They represent a break with some very familiar habits and traditions. It is only human to instinctively avoid anything that shifts thoroughly from the acceptable, comfortable past. But the world is governed by ceaseless change, and we must therefore establish links with the present and future as well as the past. Computer technology is an excellent case in point, as the newest systems grow out of date in only a few years or even months. This ability to see, experience, and accept the new is one of our saving characteristics. To be fearful of tomorrow, to close ourselves to possibilities, to resist the inevitable, to advocate standing still when all else is moving forward, is to lose touch. If we accept the new with joy and wonder, we can move gracefully into each tomorrow. More often than not, the children shall lead us.
Very good.
Lesson 49.
Let children learn to judge their own work. A child learning to talk does not learn by being corrected all the time. If corrected too much, he will stop talking. He notices 1,000 times a day the difference between the language he uses and the language those around him use. Bit by bit, he makes the necessary changes to make his language like other people's. In the same way, children learning to do all the other things they learn to do without being taught to walk, run, climb, whistle, ride a bicycle, compare their own performances with those of more skilled people, and slowly make the needed changes. But in school, we never give a child a chance to find out his mistakes for himself, let alone correct them. We do it all for him. We act as if we thought that he would never notice a mistake unless it was pointed out to him, or correct it unless he was made to. Soon, he becomes dependent on the teacher. Let him do it himself. Let him work out, with the help of other children, if he wants it, what this word says, what the answer is to that problem, whether this is a good way of saying or doing this or not. If it is a matter of right answers, as it may be in mathematics or science, give him the answer book. Let him correct his own papers. Why should we teachers waste time on such tiring work? Our job should be to help the child when he tells us that he can't find the way to get the right answer. Let's end all this nonsense of grades, exams, marks. Let us throw them all out and let the children learn what all educated persons must someday learn, how to measure their own understanding, how to know what they know or do not know.
Close your eyes, relax, listen, and follow. 闭上你的眼睛，放松，仔细听，并跟着读。You can make it. 你一定可以做到。
Lesson 50. On Christmas Eve a few years ago, an English couple received a very special telephone call. It was only a 20-second call, but it was very important. The Haydens' 15-year-old daughter had disappeared 6 months before. On Christmas Eve, she rang them. I'm phoning to wish you a happy Christmas, she said. I love you. Ronald and Edwina Hayden were so happy that they started a special telephone service called Alive and Well. The service helps parents to get in touch with children who have run away from home. Young people can phone Alive and Well and leave a message for their parents. The telephones are answered by answering machines, so no one can speak to the child or make him return home. Parents of runaway children who are under 18 can ask the police to bring their children home. So children do not want to tell their parents where they are. Through Alive and Well, they can telephone their parents without worrying about this or giving out their addresses. The Haydens and their helpers write down the tape-recorded telephone messages and connect the addresses given. Many of the 30,000 British teenagers who have left home are probably in London. For only 2 pence, they can go into a telephone coin box and call their parents. They can dial 567-5339 and stop a parent's worry. Is he dead or alive?
You really did a good job.
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 Feel great about yourself. 为自己感到自豪吧。
This is your old friend Jim, saying goodbye and good luck and keep having fun with English.
Hi, this is Stephanie. It's been great speaking English with you. See you next time.
Bye-bye.
Congratulations. 祝贺你。
You really did a good job. Yeah.